Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about the opposite of the placebo effect. So you've heard of the positive effect that you can get from expecting to feel better when you get a sham pill or an M&M instead of the medicine you're thinking you're going to get. You can still get better. Well, there's an opposite reaction. It's called the nocebo effect, and we'll be exploring that in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science. But as always, we start off looking back at the week's science news, and joining me is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Ruth, our first story has to do with frostbite.
Yeah, not a condition that we face a lot of the times here in Ireland, and not one that's very common, but one that actually is really important to get some attention, because it's actually something that happens. We kind of think about mountain climbers maybe getting frostbite, but it's a big issue for people who don't have homes as well. And it can be a really debilitating condition, because at the moment, well, until now, the treatment has been amputation for severe frostbite, because it is a thermal condition. It happens when the tissues, usually in your extremities, primarily your fingers, your toes, maybe your nose, just get too cold, the blood supply shuts down, you can get clots and you can get gangrenous tissue. And once the tissue dies like that, there's nothing you can really do about it until now. And this is a drug, it's a drug that's been around actually for decades, but it's kind of been repurposed for frostbite. And it's unusual because we don't know fully why it's working for frostbite. So it's a prostaglandin drug. It's a drug that vasodilates, so it helps your vessels to open up. And it's been used for people with blood pressure conditions, you know, to help lower blood pressure. But a trial was done. It's quite a small trial. It was 47 people, and they were treated over 12 years. And some patients got this drug. It's called Iloprost. They got that on its own. Some people got another vasodilator. So there's an awful lot of drugs out there that do similar things to this drug. And other patients got a Iloprost plus something that stopped clotting. And actually the Iloprost on its own was the most successful. And of the 16 patients out of the 47 that got that on its own, none of them required any amputation, whereas patients in all the other groups did too. And that's kind of interesting because we don't really understand why. So certainly this drug, it's a vasodilator primarily. It mimics molecules in the body that do that naturally. It probably also has some ability to stop clots, but the scientists looking at it think it may also help red blood cells get through very small vessels. And that's obviously one of the issues with frostbite. It's constriction and the cells aren't getting through. So it seems to work much better than other vasodilators for this condition. So, I mean, that's good news. They're talking now about having it as a sort of emergency medication on places like Everest. It does need to be given intravenously, but they're talking about having stations where you could, if you have frostbite, be flown into a station, given an infusion of this over a few days, and you would probably recover fully. But obviously, you know, the other category of people that might need it, you know, people that work in extreme conditions for whatever reason, because of their job, you know, that might be a more important case where we need to have drugs like these to prevent amputation from frostbite, because, you know, it's obviously debilitating. And most people who get amputations from frostbite, about 20% of them have very significant permanent life altering changes from that. Yeah. So great to hear that there's something that can be done now.
I'm not sure if this is in the article you read, Ruth, but how quickly do you need to treat a patient to prevent that amputation? And what sort of temperatures and duration of exposure typically leads to frostbite?
It's very, very varied. That's one thing in terms of who gets exposure to frostbite, because, you know, again, you'll find some people, there's a condition called Raynaud's disease, which this drug was also used for, where people actually have quite constricted blood vessels anyway. So for people like that, they're going to potentially get frostbite when they're only exposed to extreme cold for a few hours. There's other people who can survive for much, much longer without getting frostbite. But with this injury, I mean, you can get this to people within days and weeks and still potentially help to recover the tissues, but it all depends how far the frostbite is gone, how much tissue has been damaged, whether the tissue has actually, you know, become gangrenous. So obviously you can't save gangrenous tissue, but it's all about improving the outcomes and avoiding bone damage and the need to do an amputation, which really was the only recourse for surgeons now. You know, they could go in and do surgeries before where they tried to disconnect the nerves from the vessels, get them to open up again if they get in quickly. But really, you know, moving away from either amputation or those kind of radical surgeries to a fairly straightforward infusion is a big step forward. I mean, the challenge is we don't know how much this is going to cost yet. So this is a drug that's been repurposed by a small biotech company. You know, they will be able to get a new license now for this new use. So it's probably not going to be that cheap. And of course, that's where the downside is. You know, you could have whole populations of people for whom this would be incredibly useful and important, but they might be sort of priced out of getting it.
I'm reminded of Future Proof's trip to the Arctic Circle with producer John Fardy, who now does the movie show on News Talk. And he went to the Arctic Circle of minus 35 degree evenings in a pair of Wellington boots. It was a moment when he came in from a husky ride that we had done for the program that I thought, because our husky leader was missing three fingers, and I was like, this might be the end of John's foot. He warmed us sufficiently though, so that's good. None of that drug required. Our second story, Shane, has to do with social media. And there's a lot of talk about the effect of social media in the papers this week.
Yeah, this is a paper from colleagues in Manchester University, and it's published in Nature Mental Health. And its finding is really interesting because I think it goes against what we might think is the obvious answer. So it suggests that time spent on social media is amongst the least influential factors in determining adolescent mental health difficulties. That's quite the statement, right? Because yeah. I think the assumption would be certainly from most media quarters that social media is the cause of all evils, including adolescent mental health. There's a lot of concern about the role of social media in the well-documented increase in adolescent mental health. So nobody's disputing that there is an increase in adolescent mental health issues. But what this study has been looking at is the perhaps more complex and inconclusive reasons for that. This is built on a worldview from the 20th century where we have really looked for the reason when it comes to most mental health issues. In other words, there is a simple, often reductive approach to just finding that reason and either medicating or certainly pathologizing people who live with them. But what this study has been able to do is to do something called a panel network analysis. So instead of looking at the influence of individual factors, right, and social media use might be one, they've looked at how factors within mental health, well-being, and one's social life interact with one another. And they did this as part of a huge longitudinal study. And we've mentioned a lot of these from the UK in recent years. So this particular study was able to draw upon data from 12,041 UK adolescents. So it's a huge sample size. And they looked at, as I said, at connections between different factors that are associated with mental health, well-being, and social life. I mention all of those because not all of those are negative things. One's well-being and social life can and should be indeed very positive, as indeed your mental health might be. They found that time spent on social media does predict the concentration of mental health difficulties for women and girls. But overall, it's amongst the smallest determinants of mental health challenges. For example, school, a feeling dissatisfied with school has twice the influence that social media use does. They found for males, for men and boys, that social media was not at all a predictor of mental health difficulties, but it was an outcome. So in other words, if you were having mental health issues, you may become more likely to use social media a lot. But they were finding that things like bullying was a far stronger predictor of having mental health challenges. And they recognized, again, the complexity of all of these things coming together. So what I take from this is that we can really use big data and longitudinal studies in a very effective way to go beyond the simple, you know, one fix approach. And I would hope that would empower people who provide care for these young people, and indeed who fund things like services and schools, to be more nuanced in their approach so that they can really get to the tricky nature of these things.
Yeah, and I think this can extend beyond just social media to screen time, which has been really vilified in the press over the past decade, and lots of various sources saying that screen time is bad. There's different types of screen time. And it, as an example, in my home, I allow my children a very short amount of time on YouTube. I much prefer them to watch TV on Netflix or to obviously watch, you know, educational stuff, but that doesn't happen as much. But the point of it is that with Netflix, a show has been created by writers who've thought about it, who are including cultural references. It's of the time. And there's a character arc, there's story, there's, you know, there's craft gone into it, which is very different from watching somebody watch somebody else watch a YouTube video. And by the way, this is a strange phenomenon, but it is absolutely pervasive in young people. I don't know if you've noticed this, these videos of other people watching like fail videos. And I think that does, to me, raise a question as to why are children looking for company when they're watching these videos to watch something else? And I think that person in the screen is the friend of the watcher as they watch the content.
But what I take overall is that, you know, the answers that we would have intuitively known tend to be the correct ones. As in, if we can build societies that care for more people and afford us more time to build relationships and build education systems that develop that, you know, that's a far more complex thing to do. But it is what this study suggests. These are the right things to do instead of just picking the new thing and saying, oh, that social media, that's awful, or that AI, that's awful. Yes, they're not great, but they're not the boogeyman. They're not the big silver bullet that you think they are, perhaps. You know, there's more to these complex issues.
Been happening since Jazz, Elvis, the TV, right? We've always had these...
Even the sewing machine.
Yeah. All right, Ruth, our third story has to do with the potential for AI to create bioweapons.
Yeah, and we've talked before about the potential of AI to do good things, like potentially find new drugs, which would indeed be proteins. But of course, the flip side of that is perhaps AI could be used to find biological molecules that could be used as bioweapons. And this is an initiative that was launched this week. It's sort of a voluntary code that people working in this area are proposing that they should all sign up to. So it came out of an AI safety summit that was hosted in the University of Washington by the Institute of Protein Design last October, where this topic was discussed. And it involves scientists from the United States, from Europe, and from Asia. And essentially, they are signing up to having committees that would regularly review the kind of software and the tools that are being used in AI, particularly when it comes to designing new biological molecules, and I suppose voluntarily agreeing that they need to put safeguards in place over the course of the next decade to ensure that this isn't used for malevolent purposes, for example, to create bioweapons. They're also proposing that there would be some levels of screening built in, because obviously if you use AI to design a molecule, you then have to make that molecule in a lab, and that will usually involve a DNA synthesis step, and then you create the protein. And then there's loads of companies where you can order online your DNA. So they're proposing there should be checks and balances put in place with companies like that, so you can't just rock up and order anything that you want. Some of the conversation is around maybe we need to build AI into those companies to detect when something that's being ordered may potentially be used for a negative outcome. And certainly, like, this is not going to get rid of the need for regulation in this area either.
Realistically, bioweapons, how deployable would this sort of a technology be? I mean, like, are we talking like aerosol type thing?
Well, lots of different bioweapons can be released in all sorts of different ways. They can be aerosolized, they can be released. But I suppose at the moment, at least, this type of research is not producing very dramatic outcomes. We know in the drug delivery space, actually, it's a pretty high failure rate at the moment. So we're not seeing a slew of successful outcomes yet. But, you know, that's all the more reason why we need to have these conversations now to decide what we actually want to allow this technology to be able to do.
Shane, our final story has to do with bees.
Yes, and this time getting a B is the best outcome in this test, because what we have seen in this study from Queen Mary is that bumblebees are able to teach one another. And they're able to teach one another using a process that we thought only humans could do, which is social learning, right? So it isn't just figuring it out on your own, it's others showing you what to do. I love these studies because they get to work with bees, but they found bumblebees. We don't know if consent was given, and the bees had to do a two-step puzzle to get reward. Crucially in this study, a single bee wouldn't have been able to figure out the two steps on their own. It was just too complex. But what they found was that if they're able to teach a certain cohort of bees to do the first step and then introduce new bees, the new bees could learn the first step from their pals and then figure out the second step on their own. So they were able to basically build on the knowledge of others, right?
How are bees not running the world?
Well, this is what the paper says, is that, you know, do bees have culture? Because that's what culture is us collectively building on the shared knowledge that's between us. So no human could ever claim to know everything, right? Maybe you, Jonathan, but no normal human could claim to know everything.
I would have been happy with a bee, Shane. I'd be happy with a bee anytime. So what was the task that they were taught to do?
So it was a two-step puzzle box. So it was a figuring out thing, a mechanical process in order to get to sweet food, right? Some nectar like substance. So they had to figure out what it is they could do. And as I say, these mechanical movements would have been for one bee who was completely new to the situation, an impossible task. So it was that they needed some bees to be trained to do the first task in order for the new bees to arrive and learn to do the whole lot.
Really quickly, people might remember on the show, our jaws were collectively dropped when we heard that the waggle dance that we were so in love with bees was really only a very small part of figuring out where to fly, that actually a large part of it was just following the bee. The bee flew to where it was, which I know ruins a lot of people's idyllic idea of bees. When they were teaching the task, was this a waggle dance sort of thing? Or did they see the mechanism by which they passed on the information? Or was it just following the bee?
The paper, as I read it, didn't give that degree of detail, but I'm very curious to go and look now and see if they have YouTube videos of the bees doing this. I hope they do. And if they do, perhaps you'll be able to tweet them.
That's a wonderful way to spend Sunday afternoon. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation, thanks very much for joining us. Has it ever happened to you that a friend has said, "Oh God, you look awful," and suddenly, as if by magic, you find yourself suddenly feeling unwell, despite the fact that you felt fine just a moment ago? Well, your friend is probably not a witch. You've just experienced the nocebo effect. And this effect doesn't just make you think you might be unwell, but it can actually elicit objectively measurable symptoms like rashes. But how? Well, Charlotte Blees is Associate Professor in the Department of Women and Children's Health at Uppsala University in Sweden and co-author of The Nocebo Effect, When Words Make You Sick. She joins me now. Charlotte, welcome to the program. Talk to us about this idea. We've heard of the placebo effect in medicine, where people get told by a doctor in a white coat that they're going to feel better once they take this medicine. And all of a sudden, they start feeling better even before the actual active ingredient has kicked in. What is the nocebo effect?
The nocebo effect is often characterized as the evil twin of the placebo effect. So it's the idea that when you expect to feel worse, as a result of that expectation, it's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, adverse prophecy, where you actually do feel worse. So to give an example, recently I had to take a bus from Belfast to Dublin and I was not feeling very well. And on the journey, I really thought I was going to be sick. I was feeling nauseous. But aware of this effect, I started to think of everything under the sun other than what I was feeling like in order to do my best to dial down this kind of negative expectation. Because I think we've all been there where you think, oh my goodness, I'm going to be sick. And then all of a sudden, yes. So there's a kind of a perhaps not a very pleasant, but graphic example of how nocebo effects may work, sort of at a superficial level ultimately. But we've all experienced these nasty effects, possibly that come from negative expectations.
That word expectation is everything really, isn't it? Because this is the way that placebo and nocebo works. When we say expectation, what do we mean?
That's a very good question. It's the kind of the money question. I think there's an awful lot of work carried on this in terms of it functioning as a suitable explanation. So in a certain common sense level, we understand what it means. It's a kind of a bridge between the psychological and the physical, if you will. It's the ultimate mind-body problem. But in terms of expectations, what does that actually mean in practice? It can mean several things. It could mean, for example, something like classical conditioning. So we've heard of Pavlov's dog, where the dog heard the bell ringing before lunch every day. The bell, so it has this learned association between the stimulus and the outcome. And it could be that in many circumstances, so then when the bell rings, the dog has salivates as if dinner's about to be served. So it could be that this kind of conditioning is in play sometimes. So, for example, there's some interesting studies among cancer patients who have undergone chemotherapy, and sort of after the regime of treatment, being in a particular clinical environment, the smells of the environment and so on, and they experience nausea, feel unwell, lots of nasty side effects, as many people, for example, undergoing chemotherapy may do. But then back in the clinical environment, they, not getting any of the treatment, still experience those feelings of nausea. So some of it could be the expectation, the underlying mechanisms could be to do with things like conditioning. But I sort of put my head above the parapet here and be honest, I don't think we have a clear enough mechanistic story to tell yet.
Cancer is a really interesting one because people have this conception of treatment for cancer that it is extremely grueling and exhausting and it takes so much out of you. And that is the case for a large number of patients. But there are some patients who don't feel like that. Is there a way of separating out scientifically the patients who might have felt okay, but because they were expecting to feel these awful symptoms may have had a worse experience in treatment?
So one way to do that is to ask people what their expectations are, in which case we're asking them to think of sort of consciously what do you expect is going to happen. We get into a kind of murky area when we talk about non-conscious expectations. But one way to ask that question is to say, do you expect to feel worse? One of my colleagues, Andrew Gears, did a study of with COVID-19 vaccine. And what he found was he asked people, do you expect to feel worse after receiving the vaccine? And in fact, measuring the expectation, that was associated with, in fact, people feeling worse from side effects of the COVID vaccine.
Wow.
Now the issue there is, is this because they've had prior... there could be multiple explanations in play. So perhaps you've got some vulnerability, you already experienced side effects you might know that you're going to, or you might be feeling ropey anyway and you expect to feel worse. So it's underdetermined what is going on. But studies like that help us to sort of inch closer incrementally to getting a grasp on this really difficult phenomenon to experimentally get at.
I was reading a book on the placebo effect, and it appeared in some studies, and the studies were limited, but it appeared that taking a single pill didn't give as strong as a placebo effect as taking two pills, that certain colored pills like red would give a stronger nocebo effect, that if you were to give someone a fake injection where you injected saline as opposed to a medicine, that they would have a more perceived benefit, and so on and so forth. Do we see evidence of that when it comes to nocebo, that the more exaggerated or the more serious the fake treatment, the more serious the real symptoms?
We don't yet have a hold. So the idea, as you're saying, like the more invasive the treatment, the more anxious somebody could become. And incidentally, we know that preliminary studies which suggest that the nocebo effect is associated with hormones like cortisol, there is an increase in anxiety related hormones. How do you interpret that's another issue, but I digress. But the issue being, is it the worse the anticipation, the more negative? We would say sort of commonsensically, we would expect that to be the case, but there really isn't enough research there yet. And in fact, again, to be the studies in placebo research where, for example, take multiple pills or an injection might be more therapeutic via the placebo effect than a pill and so on. Those research, I've just published a paper on that, which may not have gone down very well with my colleagues. Thinking about the replication crisis here, a lot of those studies, and I've cited them myself, they're very small sample size and they need to be replicated. So we've got to be cautious with this research too. We're doing an interview on radio. It's a very media-friendly research. Everybody's interested in these kind of mind-body effects, but we also have to be careful, do our due diligence when it comes to sort of researcher allegiance and replicating these studies.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How do we go about measuring physical effects of placebo or nocebo? Is it possible to do ethical treatments on people and fake giving them something that's going to make them feel bad? How do you research something like that?
Yeah, it's a very, very thorny area. To the first question, yes, we can try to get at objective measures. For example, again, but these are tricky studies to run in eliciting an allergic response, for example, in healthy, normal participants, and then seeing if the demeanor of the practitioner can reduce the size of the rash on the skin, or in fact make it worse. But there's no studies really on the nocebo effect on that. The placebo effect there is. Again, those studies need to be replicated. But the majority of these studies are self-report studies of feeling more pain, fatigue, whatever.
Yeah, we don't like those on this show.
it's a really tricky area because degree of health.
But we do see changes in heart rate, right? We do see spikes in cortisol from a nocebo with a sham medicine. So we do know things are definitely happening in the body as a result of suggestion and expectation. So this is very much a real thing. But how to measure it is a really interesting question.
I would just say sort of part of the invitation of the book, because this is the first book that's really focused on this more negative evil twin, as I say, that is singularly focused on it. So part of the reason for the book is an invitation to this area of research to say, you know, we've got to undertake more robust methodological studies here because it has massive repercussions. If verbal suggestions in the clinic make a difference to reported side effects, this is something medicine needs to care about. You know, sort of go back to the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm.
Yeah, but isn't it a bit tricky to suggest or even contemplate that medical professionals should shy away from saying, from talking about the negative side effects of a medicine? I mean, ethically, we can't do that, although it may have a benefit. You have to tell people if they're going to feel a side effect and to watch out for that, right?
I think this is the rub. Yeah, because there's a real ethical dilemma here. People now expect their doctor to give it to them straight. What are the side effects? Like when I got my COVID injection, I remember the nurse said to me, and I really wish you hadn't, she said 12 hours, she's very specific, 12 hours from now you might start to get a headache, fever, but just take a couple of paracetamol. And I remember looking at my watch and it was about 12 hours later. I said, God, I feel terrible. I wish you hadn't told me this, knowing something about the nocebo effect. So yeah, it's a tricky area because we expect honesty from clinicians and they have a duty to give it, to be honest. But the dilemma arises. They also have a duty not to do harm. So how do we resolve this dilemma? Is it through some kind of pre-authorized disclosure? Do you want to know about potential side effects? It could be about framing the side effects differently instead of saying 20% of people experience, you know, nausea after this, saying 80% of people don't experience any side effects, something like that. So there are ways in which we could potentially be honest, but framing it differently to get a different outcome.
I think that definitely has potential as an idea to reframe positive and negative communication of side effects. There was also a study in that book that suggested that if you tell people that the pill you're giving them is a sugar pill, but it will do them benefit, that they still benefit from a placebo effect. Is there a reverse for that in the nocebo?
So this is where some of the studies where you randomize patients to two groups where we do see some interesting findings. So for example, actually take COVID, the COVID-19 vaccine. So randomizing patients to the placebo, they weren't getting the vaccine or the Verum injection. Patients who were allocated to the placebo also reported side effects. To the extent it's estimated that two-thirds of, this is over lots of clinical trial data review called a sort of meta-analysis, found about two-thirds of the side effects were possibly attributed to nocebo effects.
Wow.
Which is a staggering finding. And again, teasing apart whether this was negative expectation or it could be misattributing the vaccine to low-level symptoms. So, for example, at any moment, you know, we may experience headache or too many glasses of wine the night before.
Might be a coincidence.
Could be a coincidence and a misattribution to the vaccine. Or it could be the misattribution plus thinking that nasty vaccine has given me something, then makes the symptoms worse, in which case it could be a sort of dialing up of the nocebo effect. So there's a lot to tease apart here.
Realistically, is it important from a clinical point of view when we think of long-term outcomes? Because the thing about placebo is it drops off a cliff very quickly. When it comes to pain or any benefit you might receive from the placebo effect, it disappears pretty quickly and it doesn't last. Medicines do last, and that's why we use them. And they need to perform better than placebo. When it comes to nocebo, do you think there's clinical significance to studying this?
Yeah, I really do. A couple of reasons. Medication, it sounds a very paternalistic word, but lack of adherence to medication. Patients just not sticking with it because of side effects is a huge issue. It's a very costly issue as well. So if there's a way in which we can mitigate that, that would be important. Or again, go back to COVID vaccines. 70% of the world's population had a first injection. But one of the reasons cited for not getting a second was side effects. And that might also have put other people, word of mouth, don't get this. That there are other, even if they were only small side effects, it didn't really last. People don't want to feel rubbish, especially if they're already feeling a bit cynical. So I think from a behavioral healthcare, public health perspective, we should take these things seriously.
Absolutely fascinating subject. The world of the nocebo effect. The name of the book is The Nocebo Effect. When Words Make You Sick. The author is Charlotte Blees. Charlotte, thank you so much. That was fascinating.
You're welcome.
There are episodes through history of people getting sick when they see someone else being sick and think that there might be something in the air or whatever, like episodes of mass hysteria. I think there was one in a textile factory in America in the 60s where one guy got sick and then started puking, and then the other person thought they'd picked it up, and it just went on from there, and like 62 people were hospitalized or at least got very sick as a result of this hysterical episode, like mass psychogenic illness, I believe the term is. And there's a bunch of these over time. There's one in a plane, I believe, where people thought they'd been poisoned. And Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, wrote about some nuns who were choking and had these sort of fits because they believed they had been possessed by the devil. And I think you can attribute all those, that same idea of expecting to be unwell because that's what's around you. Really interesting. Right. Time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And if you remember, we were talking about mining the moon and why we would want to do that. We got an email in saying, if the moon is mined and the material is shipped off the moon, at what point would the loss of mass of the moon have an effect on Earth, tides, etc.? I think it would need to be quite a chunky bit of the moon. I think just, mining the moon for a bit probably wouldn't make a huge amount of difference. It would need to be a sizable amount, I think, for it to have a major impact on tidal activity, I think. Another person says, I say rather than making sure that there aren't weapons on the moon, let's make sure there are lots of weapons on the moon. And if you want to fight a battle or a war, you get sent to the moon so the rest of us can get on with it down here. I think that is a stellar idea. An absolutely brilliant idea. If you want to have a war, you got to do it on the moon. If you survive, you can come back. But that's where you go and have your grievances and you leave people who don't want to be involved in war alone and in peace back here. Space wars. Star Wars, perhaps. Has a ring to it, doesn't it? That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Hope you enjoyed the programme. Thanks to the team, which is now just Aidan McKelvey and me. So thanks to Aidan. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Keep those emails coming in, your comments. We really do appreciate them. I'll be back on Tuesday, as I say, with more. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.